discovering stories of people living out their beliefs in our culture, communities, and the public square, and finding courage, determination, and hope. Welcome to Faith Radio's On the Road. Now, here's Ryan Thomas.
It's a one-of-a-kind journey from the upper Midwest to the clandestine front lines of the Cold War, and from classroom lectures to archaeological expeditions in Egypt's renowned Valley of the Kings. It's the one-of-a-kind life of Dr. Charles Ayling as we go on the road with the beloved professor of history at University of Northwestern St. Paul. The good doctor hails from Minnesota's Twin Cities, and he served as an intelligence officer in the United States Army for 8 years, serving in both Washington, D.C. and Germany. He's also been part of multiple archaeological excavations in Egypt, including the excavation of a royal tomb in the Valley of the Kings. He's the vice president of the Near East Archaeological Society, and he wrote the book, Egypt and Bible History, from Earliest Times to 1000 BC. And Dr. Ayling, a warm welcome to you, sir. It really is a privilege to be talking to you on the road today.
Well, it's great to be with you. I always enjoy talking to the folks, and it's good to be with you.
Well, thank you once again. Before we get to the beginning of your story, Doc, you are in the cinematic headlines these days, so I want to mention this off the top. It's a new documentary film that's actually coming out this Monday, January the 19th, in which you're interviewed, called Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, and it's a film that presents compelling, newly recognized patterns of evidence for the biblical Exodus. It's won over 13 awards during the past year from film festivals all over the country, and will be shown in over 650 theaters nationwide, and that includes many here in the upper Midwest, from the investigative filmmaker Tim Mahoney's story of a 12-year quest in search of one question: is there any evidence that the Exodus story really happened? So, Dr. Ayling, what can we expect to see from the film, and what angles specifically do you tackle in your portion?
Basically, I was asked about evidence regarding, you know, archaeological evidence regarding the life of Joseph in Egypt and his background and the Exodus and why we should believe in it and when it took place. So it was a long day of filming, but it was very fun. I'd never been involved with making a movie before, and I saw what great work it is. It's tremendous work. Sometimes we had to do one scene 10 or 12 times over to get it exactly right. But that's the kind of thing I deal with. I'm one of those talking heads like they speak of.
What is the most compelling evidence to you as a student of the period? And I know that's a general question, but you mentioned the life of Joseph specifically. What would you say is the most compelling evidence in your mind that the biblical story is historically the case?
Well, one of the things that I've studied in the last 35 years quite extensively is the subject of titles of officials in Egyptian government. And what I'm excited about is when I read about the titles that Joseph had when he was promoted and served in the Egyptian government. And we see, for example, that he was chief steward of the king, and he was vizier, you know, sort of like prime minister, the number one person under the pharaoh. And he held those jobs at the same time. Now, that's virtually an impossibility. It never happens. But recently, a German archaeologist pointed out that there was a man right in the period the Bible would date Joseph to, around 1850 BC or thereabouts, who did hold both those titles simultaneously. And that's the only example known in Egyptian history. And I don't believe that person was Joseph, because we know his name and his family and so on. But it's interesting to me to realize that there was an example right at the time the Bible would place Joseph in Egypt. And the fact is, I think probably the other man was a successor to Joseph. Joseph probably did so well holding both those jobs that he was the next man was given the same titles. So to me, that's very exciting. Also, there's a tomb that's been discovered in northern Egypt from about the same time period that was the tomb of an Asiatic, a person from Palestine, who had served as an official in the Egyptian government. And it's provable that the man was an official, and it's provable that he was a Palestinian. And while his name is not preserved, if this guy isn't Joseph, he's somebody that had a career just like Joseph.
It strikes me that someone might be listening to us talk about a movie that's about the Exodus story, and perhaps they're just wondering, maybe they're not someone who is a great student of the story, or maybe they are, but maybe they're wondering, why does it matter whether the story actually happened or not?
Well, because if you start denying the historicity of what the Bible talks about, it becomes a kind of slippery slope. And if we say there was no Exodus, perhaps then there was no Jesus Christ. And perhaps there was no resurrection of Jesus Christ. Jesus himself spoke often of Moses and the truth of the Old Testament. So I think the belief in one is connected with the other. So if we believe in the historical accuracy of Scripture, it has to go all along the line, in my opinion.
All right, Dr. Charles Ehling, appearing in Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, and that's being released on Monday. That's January the 19th as a one-night-only event, and you can find a theater near you and check out the trailer as well, in which the good doctor appears as well at patternsofevidence.com. All right, doctor, let's make the turn back to where it began for you, sir. What was growing up like for you in the Twin Cities, and how did you sift through, with all the varying things you've done in your life, how did you sift through what you wanted to do when you grew up?
Well, I grew up in one of the southwest suburbs of Minneapolis and went to a high school called Edina High School. And when I was a young person, I was in a family that was a medical family. My father was a doctor. His father was a doctor. Everybody back, as far as we could trace, since the family came over from England back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, everybody was in the medical profession somehow. So when it came time to go to college, I really didn't think I even had a choice. I had to go to pre-med and had to become a doctor. So I went to the University of Minnesota and was majoring in pre-med. Now, while I was there, majoring in pre-med, my advisor told me that I had to take something that wasn't a science course. He said, "Don't bother me, sign up for something that isn't science." And so I decided, well, I've always kind of liked history. So I signed up for an ancient history course. Now, what I did not know is that it was the first course in the sequence to major in ancient history. I didn't know that. So anyway, I took the course, and I wasn't in there more than 5 or 6 class periods before I knew this is what I want to go into. Mm. This is absolutely it. And my father was fine with that. My mother wasn't quite so fine with it. But what is interesting is that I went to visit my elderly grandmother in the nursing home who was dying of old age. And while I was there, she asked me, "What are you studying at the university?" And I said, "Well, I'm studying basically ancient Egyptian history, and I'm going to major in that." And she said to me, "Well, your grandfather, my husband, was excited when he was alive about the discovery of King Tut's tomb, and he would be so proud of you that you're in this field." And from that point on, it was fine with my mother as well.
Wow.
So I switched over to that field.
That's tremendous. Dr. Charles Ehling joining us on the road. I'm Ryan Thomas, and it's a remarkable life Dr. Ehling has led. So was your faith something that you had from early on in your youth, sir, or was there something that brought you to it later in life?
Well, actually, I had the good fortune to be raised in a fine Christian family, and we attended a fine Bible-believing, Bible-preaching church here in the Twin Cities. So I had the opportunity to come to Christ very early in my life. So I was a person of faith when I went to the university. And, you know, one wonders, how is that going to play out when you're dealing with these faculty members? And as you get further along, get into graduate school, you're working more closely with the faculty members, who are many of them atheists, but I didn't have a real problem with that. And my immediate two professors that I worked with were both very, very sympathetic to my Christian faith, and they said I could even teach what I believed as long as I approached it from an academic viewpoint. So, because I was a TA teaching, you know, some courses over as well. But anyway, I had the strength of my faith behind me all the time, and I'd advise any young people who are going to secular universities and so on, just keep up your activity in a good church.
And it was in school, I believe, that you began your ROTC program and your military career.
Yes, indeed.
Why did you feel led to the armed services?
Well, I'd always been interested in military history. You know, you can't do much history without coming across wars and things like that.
So yes,
I was interested in it. And a good friend of mine talked to me about joining ROTC, and I said, that sounds like a lot of fun. Now, you have to realize the Vietnam War was going on at its height at this time period, and so I thought, you know, once I get out of school, it'd be a lot better to go in as an officer than just be drafted and end up in Vietnam or something to that effect. So basically, I joined the ROTC program, and I loved the program. They had a great ROTC. They still do at the University of Minnesota. And so when I graduated, when I got ready to graduate from ROTC, you get to choose the branch of the Army that you're going to go into. And they give you three choices, and they don't guarantee you anything. They say, we will probably give you one of your three choices, but you have to choose three branches. So I decided, I told the administration of the ROTC that I would like to choose military intelligence as my number one choice. And they told me, they said, don't do that. They said, that is too hard to get into. Nobody gets it. Choose something else. And I said, well, I said, Colonel, I would like to try it if I could. And so he was not very pleased with me, but he let me try it, and I got it.
We're talking to Dr. Charles Ayling, professor of history at University of Northwestern St. Paul. I'm Ryan Thomas as we go on the road for Faith Radio. And I have heard you tell a certain story, and so I have to basically ask this question as an excuse to get you to tell this story. But the story of your trek to Cairo, and when we talk about how close the actual life of an Army intelligence officer comes to the reality of being an Army intelligence officer, could you tell that story of your detour to Cairo and being having a nice conversation with the Egyptian secret police?
I'm there in Egypt, and I'm doing all this excavation, and the country at that time was occupied by the Russian military. There were Russian soldiers all over the place, and that was a little kind of worrying, because in my luggage was the complete uniform of an Army intelligence officer of the U.S. Army. So anyway, one night I was sleeping in my hotel, and there was a knock at the door, and this is about midnight or thereabouts, and it was the Egyptian secret police, and they said, come with us. And they didn't speak much English other than that, so I couldn't ask them any questions, and I was quite scared. You know,
of course.
Thought, oh boy, they have found out what I can do here, and that I'm an Army intelligence officer. So anyway, I went down to the headquarters with them, and I didn't know what was going to happen. But the man at headquarters there, and this is in the city of, actually not in Cairo, this was in Luxor, Egypt. The man there at the office said, he spoke pretty good English, and he told me, he said, you know, we noticed that there was a mistake in your visa application, and your visa has already expired. So we need you to sign this piece of paper, and then you can go back and go to bed again. So, I signed the paper and left and went back home, back to the hotel again.
Never been more happy to have visa problems in Egypt.
That's right. And never so happy to see an old hotel room before in my life.
Well, what role did your faith play in the midst of times like this? Because you mentioned that you were understandably afraid. I mean, did God really supply you with the peace and the strength that you needed to get through times like that?
Yes, he really did. You know, as I walked down to the secret police headquarters, you know, I could say I was concerned, but really I didn't feel any dreadful fear. I didn't think they were going to pull my fingernails out or anything like that. And you know, that sort of thing could have happened. But yeah, I think one's faith is an important thing. And I still get all kinds of opportunities to speak in churches. I'm practically out every Sunday speaking in a different church on either archaeological topics or historical topics, things like that.
That's tremendous. That's tremendous. So did your path then, after your military service concluded, did your path take you to Northwestern pretty swiftly, or was there a time period between those two?
Yeah, fairly swift. When I was, after I'd come back from my archaeological work the first time, I was employed at a school down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a Christian college. You know, when I first finished my doctoral work, I figured, boy, this area is so related to Scripture, every Christian college must have three or four people teaching this material. And I found out real quickly that wasn't the case. I finally got a position down in Chattanooga at Tennessee Temple University and taught there. My wife and I taught there for 4 years. And then I got a chance to be, and I was through with the Army by this time, but I got a chance to be dean of a seminary here in the Twin Cities, a brand new seminary that had started in a church. And so I came up and took that position. And so the seminary only existed for about 4.5 years. And at the end of it, I didn't know what I was going to do, but God provided. And I sent a letter of application and got in over here at Northwestern, where I've been ever since. I was when I got here, they didn't have a history department or a history major. And so I got the chance to be in on the ground floor of starting a history department and a history major. And in fact, for the first 26 years of its existence, I was the chair of the history department here at Northwestern, and just relinquished that position last year. Now I'm no longer the chair of the department, but I think 26 years is long enough going to all those meetings, long enough for anybody. But anyway, I've been here ever since, and got a chance to create the program, create the courses, and it's really been fun.
Well, your archaeological efforts, I imagine that really adds a depth to your study of history. What is it about archaeology that you find so fascinating from when you were a youth and discovered it to this day?
Well, I think the thing is, when you're out there digging, you never know what's going to come up. You absolutely never know what you're going to find. And it can be difficult at times. The heat is difficult. It was when we were excavating there in the summertime in Egypt, it was about 120 degrees by noon every day. And of course, you have the sickness because you're not used to the food and not used to the water and all that kind of thing. So those are difficulties. And it can be rather dull if you're digging and you're not finding anything. But the minute you find something exciting, that is really makes the whole thing worthwhile. For example, when I was there digging the tomb of King I, who is actually the successor of King Tut, the lid to his sarcophagus had never been found. The sarcophagus itself, the box, granite box that they put the coffin in,
yeah,
that was sitting in the tomb and had been taken out about 1920 or something up to the Cairo Museum, but nobody had ever found the lid. And the tomb was filled with debris, about a meter deep off the floor. And it was actually my shift of excavating when we went down and found that lid at the bottom. It had been tipped off the sarcophagus, and it was lying under all this mud and muck. And we tipped it over, and the inscription on it in hieroglyphs was absolutely perfect. And this object, of course, we gave it to the Egyptian museum there in Cairo. And but if we could have sold that on the open market, I suppose an 18th dynasty Egyptian sarcophagus lid the bidding would probably have started at $250,000. These are valuable objects, and they don't come up that often. But, of course, we gave it to the Egyptians. It was their territory, their country, and,
sure,
and we didn't profit by it at all. But that kind of thing is extremely exciting. And also, just the things you might find as you're digging. You might find a pile in a deserted tomb that nobody cares about of mummies. And I tore off a few pieces of mummy cloth, which I brought back, which are particularly fun if you're out speaking in churches. People love to touch a piece of linen that was actually on a mummy.
Of course.
So all that kind of stuff is really fun to have. Now, another form of work that we did was copying inscriptions. And that's fun, too, because you're not so much looking for something new, but you're looking for, information about history. And it's right there in front of you. Nobody's ever studied it before. And to copy it and translate it, that's very rewarding as well.
Dr. Charles Ayling joining us on the road today on Faith Radio. And I'm Ryan Thomas. You know, just statistically, doctor, from a big picture perspective, and you alluded to it earlier, most people of your intellectual achievement and your academic pedigree don't tend to be people of faith.
And no.
Why is that, do you believe, and why are you different?
Well, part of it has to do with the fact that I'm from the Midwest. that may seem strange, but you find that many, many people who are involved in these academic fields that are a little more esoteric than normal, there are a lot of people that are, and I don't mean to demean them, but there are a lot of people in American history and so on, but there aren't very many people that are into Egyptology. And if they come from areas of the country where there may not be as strong an evangelical influence, I think that accounts for some of it. But the tradition of teaching these fields has always been pretty much a non-faith-based tradition ever since at least the 1880s or so, primarily because of German influence and higher criticism of the scriptures and all of that. And so a lot of people have gotten swept away with that and carried away with it. And I think that's a reason for it. But none of those things actually applied to me. I came from a good Christian family. My father actually knew Billy Graham very well. And my father was the attending physician at the death of Dr. W.B. Reilly, the founder of Northwestern. So I had all kinds of contacts with these people, and so I never I never gave a thought to giving up my faith. And basically, it was my faith challenged in classes, sure. But that just, in my case, just sharpened my faith. I had to really know what I believed when I went into these classes at the university. And I can say that, and this may not be true of everybody in this kind of situation, but I can really say that it challenged me to know what I believed, and it strengthened my faith tremendously.
Do you have any advice for a student who's perhaps pursuing a path that's somewhat similar to yours in holding on to that faith in the midst of the challenges that will almost certainly come?
Oh, I think there are a lot of things that can be done. For one thing is to have some good Christian academic mentors on a personal level. I had a lot of friends who were tremendous Christians. I had one friend who was a lawyer and had two PhDs. They weren't in my field, but a man like that is no fool, and he was able to give me lots of great advice. And my pastor was a very highly educated man. It's always significant and important for a young person to have somebody they can go to if they get a challenge to their faith or whatever, sure. Somebody to talk to. Also, read good books. Read good books by Christian scholars. I encourage my students, if you don't know what some of these books may be, get in touch with me, and I'll tell you what books to read. You'll find that there are a lot of just wonderful works of scholarship out there that will support the scriptures. They don't get as much publicity and fame as the atheistic stuff does, but they're very good. So I think that's very important. And as I said, I tell the students to maintain a membership and be active in a good, solid, Bible-believing church. That's key. You don't want to give up going to church just because you're a grad student in some university someplace. And another thing about my experience, I lived at home. I didn't live in the dorms. I didn't live in a strange city. I lived at home, went to the University of Minnesota, and lived right with my parents. And so that helped me to maintain a good Christian base all the time. So I think those are some key things. On the academic side, I would encourage students that are into this and who want to get into a field like Egyptology, I'd say, first of all, realize there aren't a lot of jobs. Realize that this is not something like being a computer programmer or a nurse or something where you can get a job very readily. It's very difficult, and students need to be ready to face that challenge when they get a PhD to get a teaching position. Very difficult. Also, I would say if a student is in high school or early years of college, study a lot of history. Take as much history of any kind as you can get. And I'd also say study languages. If you have a chance to study Greek or Latin in high school, do it. And also, as one professor told me, he said, if you're going into historical research and you're thinking about modern languages, there are three modern languages you need to learn: German, German, and German. Because a lot of the stuff the Germans write is not ever translated into English. So you got to have a good command of German. Other European languages aren't quite so important, but German is very important. And even before I knew this, of course, I can see it as God's leading looking back, but I had 4 years of German in high school.
Wow.
Taught by native speakers of the language. So that was a tremendous help to me. When I got up to grad school, and everybody else was terrified to read a book in German, I said, sure, give it to me. I'll read it. Not a problem. I think languages, particularly significant.
Understood. All right. Well, some great advice from a man who has lived a remarkable life and continues to bring his experiences to bear at University of Northwestern St. Paul. Dr. Charles Ayling has joined us on the road today. And, sir, we want to recap your film appearance coming up here on Monday, Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, the film in which you appear talking about biblical evidence for the historicity of the Exodus. That's Monday, January the 19th, a one-night only event, and you can find a theater near you and check out the trailer in which the good doctor appears as well at patternsofevidence.com. And sir, it has, as it always is, speaking with you, been a tremendous pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us on the road.
Thank you, Ryan. Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for sharing in the story of this latest episode of Faith Radio's On the Road. For more on today's conversation and the full podcast archive of all our episodes, look for On the Road when you visit myfaithradio.com.